Approximately 33 million people in the world are HIV positive, and over 3 million of them live in Nigeria. After spending 4 years there, Uzodinma Iweala had a much better understanding of the virus and how it has affected the lives of people in Nigeria. His latest book, Our Kind of People, A Continent's Challenge, A Country's Hope, tells the story of the sick, the healthy, the doctors, nurses, sex workers, parents, and children. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having
me. Now, last time you were here was to talk about your novel, Beasts of No Nation, about child soldiers in West Africa. You could have written that as nonfiction. You didn't. Why did you choose to write this book as nonfiction?
Mainly because I think the story itself demanded, I think, a nonfiction book. There have been a lot of books that are published about HIV/AIDS that deal with the stats, the facts, and the figures.
And the death toll.
And the death toll, definitely. I thought that there might be space for a book that looks at more how people are living and then moves away from the statistics and more towards the individual experiences that people had. And I wanted to really focus on interviews and people telling and narrating their own lives.
You say you find it troubling that for the rest of the world, Africa's story has been one of exploitation, famine, floods, war, now the tragic demise as a result of AIDS. Why is this troubling to you? Do you think that the positive stories of Africa are underreported?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's troubling for that reason especially. I mean, I think if you spent time in any one of the different countries on the continent, I think it's important for us to realize that it's a vastly diverse place with 52 different countries, that there are many different kinds of stories. I don't think we need to necessarily not talk about the negative stuff, but you do have to look at the variety of experience, and a lot of that is positive and productive.
Well, last week we had the vice president of Ghana on our show, and he's written a memoir that's largely about the troubled history of Ghana, but now he predicts it will be a democracy from now on because Ghana has gotten past all of that. A lot of countries haven't. Nigeria remains, despite the richness of its culture, a very troubled country.
Right. I mean, these are complex societies with many different groups of people, many different ethnicities, many different kinds of peoples, and many different ideas about how countries should be put together and run. And I think it takes time to sort that out. You know, and some countries are further along, like Ghana. It's had some troubles in the past, and now it's moving along. And we're all proud of Ghana for that. And I think places like Nigeria and other countries in sub-Saharan Africa are working out their situations.
You mentioned a speaker at an HIV/AIDS talk at Columbia University who explained the severity of HIV infection in Africa by saying, people are dropping like flies. Now, he didn't mean that to be disrespectful, but it was taken that way?
No, and he definitely didn't mean it to be disrespectful. What I sort of seized upon, and I think in the book I talk about it, my own internal thought process is just that relationship. And it's a benign statement in a lot of ways, but when you start going back and you think about all the associations of Africans as being closer to nature, all the things that people have said about Africans being more animalistic or whatever, I think in my mind I just started down this train of thought and thought, well, you know, this might be something very interesting to explore and see how this impacts how we speak in general.
The stereotypes that are applied to Africa. Well, you grew up in America. Weren't you exposed to those stereotypes?
Almost definitely. I mean, when growing up, it's, you know, if you have a name like my name, Uzodinma Iweala, you tell people you're from Nigeria, people will ask you all kinds of questions. They'll ask you things like, do you live in trees? You know, do you
really?
Yeah. I mean, when we were younger, yeah. I mean, and there were other things that were more subtle. For example, I remember one religion class that I was in where there was this this story in the book about how all Nigerians lived in mud huts and this, that, and the other. This was in my fifth grade religion class. And you know, I had a very different experience and understanding of Nigeria. And these are the things that when you're younger, you see and you get sort of annoyed about. But as you go along, you figure out how to respond to those stereotypes and what people say.
Well, you were born here, but of Nigerian parents.
Right.
So you had a sense of both worlds.
Right,
were you going back regularly?
So we would go back every other summer and spend quite a bit of time with my grandparents, my aunts, uncles, and cousins. And so, yeah, you would get this immersion into a totally different life that was different, but at the same time, you would find that, you know, people by and large around the world have the same desires and wants. And while the context might be different, there are certain things that are very, very similar about those experiences.
Well, since you still were really an American child, did you self-identify as an American?
I don't think I have sorted out yet, then or even now, how I really self-identify. I mean, I think you know, when playing with your cousins or when talking to your grandparents, there was always this teasing about, oh, you're so American, you Americana this, Americana that. But at the same time, you know, in Nigeria at least, people, once you are Nigerian, people will always remind you that, look, you are from this country. This is where your home is. This is where your village is. So, you know, it was a confusing mix of those two things, but ultimately, I think, very enriching.
Well, in your case, you did have Nigerian parents. I've spoken to African-Americans who've gone to Africa expecting to be welcomed back because of that whole roots sensibility and being treated like Americans. They said, I might as well have been white.
Right. Well, I mean, it's funny. I argue with some friends of mine who are African-American about this sometimes. And I think it's a cultural thing. I mean, if you're raised in the United States, and I even find this myself, there are certain cultural markers, identifiers that make you different from a person who's raised in, say, Nigeria or Ghana or pick any other country. And I think that because there's so much emphasis on sort of Afrocentrism and whatnot, we kind of forget that there are different cultural experiences, both which are incredibly important and enriching, that could learn from each other and that have learned and continue to learn from each other. But I think you have to acknowledge the difference to be able to do that.
My guest is Uzodinma Iweala. His latest book, Our Kind of People, A Continent's Challenge, A Country's Hope. It is published by HarperCollins. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You picked Lagos for the start of your journey. Are things worse in the capital city?
So Lagos is the largest commercial center, and Abuja is the capital.
Oh, Abuja is the capital.
Right, hours flight away. Things are not worse. I think the prevalence in Lagos is actually lower, and I forget the number, than in other places. But it's a big urban area, and I started there just because I wanted to see what, in an urban environment, what people would have to say about HIV/AIDS.
When did AIDS start to become an epidemic in Nigeria?
So I think the first case was reported in the mid-'80s, 1985.
So around the same time as we started seeing it. In fact, a little later than we started seeing it here.
In the States, yeah. I think it became a bigger deal in the 90s. Across a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria included. And, you know, that time lag, I think, was because people didn't think it was a big deal at all in sub-Saharan Africa. I think at the time, everybody was focused on homosexuals as the main population that had higher prevalence rates. And, you know, there was this whole argument that, oh, well, we don't have gay people in Africa, therefore we can't have this epidemic. You know, and I think later on, you found that in sub-Saharan Africa, it was mostly through heterosexual sex that the virus was passed. And I think then people started waking up.
How does the HIV infection rate in Nigeria compare with some of the other nearby countries like South Africa and Botswana?
So Nigeria's rate is actually relatively low percentage-wise. It's about 3.6%, just under 4%, basically. However, that translates into a very large number of people, given the size of our population. We have 160 million people, so it's about 3.3 million people, which...
The second most, was second or third most?
I think it's the third most, in largest population of people with HIV in the world. So we have a very interesting dynamic in Nigeria in that you have a disease that is there and people clearly understand its presence. But unlike in some of these other countries in sub-Saharan Africa with maybe larger percentages of population infected in Nigeria, you have a populace that might not necessarily interact on a daily basis with people who have HIV.
So only 4% are HIV positive, but that's still an awful lot of people.
It's a large number, yeah.
You talked with people from many different walks of life, a doctor, a widow, a sex worker, an AIDS activist. Did you have a list of people that you wanted to talk with when you started this project?
I think, and this is part of what I learned during the project, is that you come into one of these things thinking that there are certain kinds of people that you should interview, certain sets of people that you should talk to, because this is who would be most affected or impacted by the epidemic. And I started off that way and then found as I tried to target groups of people that I was actually more confused by and more beholden to stereotypes that I was bringing with me to the project. And so eventually into it, I relaxed and decided to just start talking and really trying to listen to people, all different kinds of people, to hear their stories.
And I suspect one person led you to another interesting person.
Right.
But how did you get them to talk to you? This is still an illness that many people consider quite private.
Right. And that, however, was one of the most interesting things, is that everyone had something to say. So, of course, there's the initial icebreaking. But once you ask people what their ideas are about HIV/AIDS rather than what they know, then all kinds of things come out. It's a different conversation than tell me what you know factually, but tell me what you think, gets people to start speaking in a very, very different way.
You open your book with a man named Jerome. Is he a real person or a character you've created to reveal the stereotypes you're trying to address here?
No, so Jerome is a real person. The story,
but
of
he
Jerome,
fits a certain stereotypical image.
Stereotype, right. Definitely a real person, but I brought that story out to say that two things. One, that these stories do exist, and I'm not trying to deny that they exist, but at the same time, they're not the only story that exists, and that we have to broaden our understanding of what stories are out there if we're really going to understand what this epidemic is about and what it means to people in a certain environment.
What does he do for a living?
Jerome?
Mm-hmm.
He is a construction worker of sorts.
And how did he meet his wife?
So Jerome was in a housing development, living in a housing development, and the woman that he eventually ended up marrying was also working for a family in that housing development.
She'd come from Abuja.
So the housing development was in Abuja, and mm-hmm. she had come to Abuja from another state.
How did she get sick? That's Agatha.
Agatha, yeah. How did she get sick? She... You know, I guess it's unclear, and that's one of the things that's very interesting about this epidemic, is in the early stages, I think for people it was unclear who got sick first or why they got sick. And I think it's later on, I think with Jerome, he goes to the doctor, and it's only later on that he finds out that he's HIV positive.
But he's hidden her from the public, in fact, refused to take her to the hospital because she would bring shame upon him.
Right. I mean, I think in that situation, it sounded like he just didn't know what to do. When the story was told to me that he wasn't really able to figure out what to do, and so therefore decided not to act as quickly as he could have until certain friends of his came into the picture and made him act.
And what's the ending of that story?
Well, in that story, and this is, again, just to illustrate, this does happen, but it's not the only thing that happens. Jerome, unfortunately, dies, and also his wife dies as well. But that's, you know, and say so in the book, that's not the only story. And we shouldn't stop at that in terms of our understanding of what HIV is within this particular society.
Nigeria is an Anglophone country. Mm-hmm. So do people call it AIDS?
Call it HIV, yeah. HIV and AIDS, yeah.
But you say it has a different name in the Hausa-speaking North.
Right. So in the Hausa North, so Nigeria, just to give background, a very complex country, 350 different ethnic groups with many, many languages. In the Hausa-speaking North, they call it Kanjamao, which means skeleton. And it's called different things in different areas. But for the most part, people refer to it as AIDS or HIV.
Now, this is one of the problems in Nigeria, that the different groups right now, if anything, are becoming more and more polarized. And there's always been tension between the Hausa North and the Christian South.
Right. I think you do see a growing polarization, but that, rather than, I think, existential, might be more related to the current political situation in the country. We have had different religions, different ethnicities coexisting for quite some time, and there's always been tension. Whenever people have different viewpoints, you'll have tension. I think now there's a much more particular political bent to it, with different interest groups fueling some of that violence that you see and hear about.
Well, how does this relate to the AIDS situation? Do different groups deal with it differently?
I think, in general, the response to AIDS in Nigeria has over the last 10 years been relatively uniform, because the federal government has put a lot of work into having a uniform response, so that education, funds for educating people about HIV/AIDS programs, I think, have been relatively equally dispersed around the country. So you go to any part of the country and people would be able to tell you what's going on.
Well, in this country, people were very critical of Ronald Reagan because he never even said the word AIDS. What was the initial reaction of the Nigerian government?
I think back in the 80s and in the early 90s, there was denial, sort of the same that you had here. And I think a lot of countries that have experienced the epidemic go through a number of different stages. Denial first, and then this acknowledgement that, oh, wow, we have a problem. And then in 1999, 2000, when President Obasanjo became president of Nigeria, I think there was an opening up, and he really acknowledged that there was an issue with HIV/AIDS in Nigeria and that we needed to tackle it.
But nearby is large South Africa, and its government, the former president Thabo Mbeki, contended that AIDS was not caused by HIV and that it could be treated by garlic. Were we hearing something similar in Nigeria?
You weren't hearing anything similar in Nigeria. And I think, you know, there's a lot wrong with what Thabo Mbeki said. I think, you know, it's inexcusable to not acknowledge the science behind it. But at the same time, I think there's a larger context for understanding why people would want to step away from the connections. And I don't think you can excuse not acting. But at the same time, I think one should step back and really try to understand why people come up with different stories for how this epidemic starts.
The reality of AIDS in Nigeria is often overlooked, as people tend to stay with the stereotypes. Uzodinma Aiwiala is here to talk about how AIDS is really affecting the people and society of Nigeria. And his book, a work of nonfiction, although he is a novelist, is Our Kind of People, A Continent's Challenge, A Country's Hope. It is published by Harper. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Uzodinma Aiwiala. His latest book, Our Kind of People, A Continent's Challenge, A Country's Hope, published by Harper. Does this mean you're going to be writing more nonfiction in the future?
I would like to. I started off writing novels, but the challenge of writing nonfiction is one that I would like to stick with as well.
Hasn't AIDS sometimes been referred to as the American invention to discourage sex in Africa?
I was reading a number of different papers that were written, and there was one that was talking about different sort of adaptations of the acronym, and one of them referred to how people had twisted or played with it to say American invention to discourage sex earlier, when people were still denying that the epidemic existed. I attended another talk actually in Nigeria while researching where, you know, the acronym had been modified again, and the person, an activist, was saying, AIDS, am I doing something to prevent this epidemic? So I think people can play around with the meaning, and I find that really interesting.
But it is interesting that it originally was, some people said, was a CIA conspiracy.
I mean, I think there are all kinds of theories that have come up about why HIV appeared and sort of the purpose and who was behind it. You know, those are stories that are important because they help formulate people's understandings, and they also give us an idea of why people responded and reacted the way they did, both internally and externally, to the epidemic. But I think it's important to recognize them as stories.
How much of an impact did the death of Fela Kuti have in the way people regarded AIDS?
So as I understand, I think Fela's death really, really woke people up in a lot of ways. His brother was a former minister of health, and his brother made the decision to announce to the Nigerian public that Fela had died of AIDS. And, you know, I remember we were there that summer when they had the funeral, and people were whispering all over and talking about how, wow, you mean it's this thing really kills, this thing is really in our society. So his death, I think, really did impact people.
Have you seen the Broadway musical based on his life?
I have.
What did you think?
I really enjoyed it. I think it's really, really well done. I think they don't talk very much about Fela and his experience with HIV and AIDS, but I think in terms of providing people with an insight into this guy's life, which was remarkable and very interesting, it's wonderful.
Well, is there still discrimination against people who have AIDS in Nigeria? In some African countries, it's been pretty terrible.
I think the stigma attached to HIV/AIDS does lead people to discriminate. It happens in Nigeria, but it happens everywhere around the world. And I think one of the things I speak about in the book is that everyone is afraid of disease in some way. And being in Africa and being afraid of disease is no more exceptional than being in the United States and being afraid of disease. Now, our issue is that in the States, there was a lot of stigma initially, but you had treatment, you had resources to put behind fighting the epidemic, so that stigma, when people realized it wasn't a death sentence, went away. It's not completely gone, but it decreased. In places like Nigeria and other resource-scarce countries, I think when people don't necessarily see hope, it becomes harder for people to then think otherwise.
Although in some countries like Botswana, drugs are given free to people who are HIV positive. What's the situation in Nigeria?
In Nigeria, you can also get treatment for free, but I think that a lot of that has to do with the PEPFAR program that was started under President Bush. And whatever you think about the former president, I think you have to give him a lot of credit for that program, which, while not perfect, has done a lot to provide and to give people this idea that you can get treated and that you can live.
What's the mission of the National Agency for the Control of AIDS, NACA?
So that exists in Nigeria as a federal-level coordinating body to coordinate the government response, to help the government work better with civil society organizations, with NGOs, and with people living with HIV/AIDS, so that as opposed to all these ad hoc responses to the epidemic, you get a sustained, coordinated, and therefore more effective response. And I think it's done well. I mean, it's not perfect, but you see that there are changes, and you see that there is improvement in terms of reduction of infections and also people getting treatment.
And you went to the NACA conference. Mm-hmm. Who were some of the attendees?
So that conference happens each year, and a number of different stakeholders, I guess they call them, from in the Nigerian fight against HIV/AIDS come. So activists, people living with HIV/AIDS, different healthcare providers, state bodies, the Ministry of Health is a participant, international organizations, to come together to discuss and try to get a better picture and assessment of where Nigeria is in its relationship and dealings with HIV and the epidemic.
One of those activists that you write about is Rolake Odetoyinbo. How did she become an AIDS activist?
So she, I think, found out that she was positive. And then there are a number of newspaper articles in which she talks about her experience thinking that things were done for her. And then having this sort of conversion experience, it almost seems like, where she realized, look, no, I can live, I can get treatment, and why should I be silent when I can tell other people that there is hope? And she's become a very prominent voice, and I was very lucky to be able to speak with her.
She's actually gone to international conferences and brought back what she's learned. It's interesting you said finding hope, because there is a woman you call Hope in this book. Yeah. I'm assuming most of the names are your inventions to protect these people. How did her husband become HIV positive?
So she doesn't know, and he doesn't know, and her husband eventually passed away. But her husband was an interstate truck driver, and there tends to be a higher rate of infection in people who move along transport corridors. So that's one possibility. But the truth is, like, we don't know, and she doesn't know. What was interesting about Hope is that that didn't necessarily seem to concern her. What concerned her more was the emotional loss that she felt from losing her husband, and then two, how she needed to modify her life now so that she could live it and be an effective mother and member of her society.
So she says, as I am now, I'm not feeling any pain. I watch the kind of food I eat and things of that sort. She also said, this is just like ordinary sickness, but AIDS is not like an ordinary sickness.
It's not an ordinary sickness, but I think what's interesting about her words is that what she was trying to communicate to me, I felt, was how this was something that she had to bring into her life, that was part of her life now, and she now had to live her life. She couldn't just stop living life. She had to live life as if how everyone else lives life. Dealing with this is one problem that happens of the many things, positive and negative, that happened in her life.
Well, AIDS obviously is often transmitted sexually. Nigeria is a country that, on the whole, seems to be rather conservative, more than some. Contracting it considered to be immoral?
I think that is changing. But yes, we are in Nigeria relatively conservative. I mean, I think you don't see sex on display in the same way that you would here in the United States or other places. And people don't necessarily speak about it as openly, but people still do speak about it. And sex, obviously, considering that there are a lot of Nigerians, does happen. So it does change the way that people talk about the epidemic. But you know, it's one of the issues in the country that we're growing in terms of how we speak about sex and how we speak about the relationship of sex to HIV/AIDS.
Well, you say only 2% of Nigerian females report having had more than one partner. Now, I don't know whether they're just people are not telling the truth, but that would still suggest that Nigeria is quite conservative.
Right. And I think, you know, there with those surveys, you have to wonder, that was from a government survey conducted. You wonder about responses and whether people are being honest with you. But I would say that Nigeria is relatively conservative, and that in some places it's more conservative than others, and that does affect the rates that you see in terms of how many people are infected with HIV/AIDS.
In order to understand how people really live with AIDS in Nigeria, Uzodinma Iweala talked to many different people, from doctors to patients and AIDS activists, and his new book on the topic is called Our Kind of People, A Continent's Challenge, A Country's Hope. In this country, for a while, people were afraid to even come in contact with people who'd come down with full-blown AIDS. Was that an issue there as well?
Yeah, I think, again, there's certain aspects of relationship to the epidemic and to the disease that are generalizable around the globe. And I think when people are confronted with something that is considered life-threatening, where there is no cure and also no hope, then the fear is a very intense response. And it was that way in Nigeria.
Well, you're right. At first, it can be hard to see beyond the manifestation of a disease, to see that before you lies a person with a disease, not a disease with a person.
Yeah, and that comes from, when I was in medical school, worked with some of the really, really wonderful doctors at Columbia, did some rotations with the HIV team. And, you know, it's the United States, there's treatment, but that there's still this initial feeling, I think, especially as a medical student, when you haven't necessarily been exposed, of fear. And you have to really work, I think I did at least, and I can only speak for myself, I had to work to get beyond that, to really understand what was going on. And this is in an environment where there's treatment, where people can get better very, very quickly. But I think that initial fear with any disease is very prevalent and needs to be reckoned with.
And it's only been fairly recently that people have recognized that cancer is not something that you get from being in contact
right.
with somebody. But actually, aren't there more people living with AIDS worldwide than with cancer?
I'm not sure of the statistics. I know that the number of people living with HIV is pretty high. I think 33 or so million is a very large number of people and demands a lot of attention. I don't know about the statistics for cancer.
Some countries in Africa, like Uganda and Botswana, have been commended for the way they've been dealing with AIDS. Has the Nigerian government been pretty good? What you've said so far would suggest it's been more enlightened than many.
Yeah, I think the Nigerian government has done a fair share. Now, does that mean the Nigerian government has done everything it could have? The answer to that is clearly no. I mean, I don't think any government ever does unless pushed by the people. I think in other places, you take Uganda, you take South Africa, for example, there have been activist communities that have really pushed. And then you've had leaders that have responded. In Nigeria, you have the activist community has been is younger in some senses, but has pushed very loudly and very vocally. And I think the government has responded in a lot of ways. And I think they're still working out their relationships and tweaking things, but I think it's been a generally positive picture.
So do you think that people who are likely to be at risk are going to have a test to find out whether they are positive?
More and more people are voluntary.
Because that's been a big issue in other countries. People have been resistant. They've been afraid to take the test, partly because they were afraid to find out that they do have the illness.
Right. And I mean, I think the response to that is, one, wouldn't all of us, if we knew that that could potentially mean that you're ostracized from society, wouldn't that then affect whether or not you decided to take a test? I think it would affect my decision. You know, at the same time, I think that people more and more are going to voluntary counseling and testing centers to get tested. You have religious leaders who are telling people, look, you know, you should get tested. You should know your status. I think that has become a very big thing. Know your status so that you know that, you know, if you need to take certain steps to prevent other people from contracting the virus from you. And also just to keep your health up in general when you have the virus.
Now, you mentioned U.S. programs. What about the U.N.? And have the pharmaceutical companies been pretty good?
So, I mean, I think across the board in the early part of the century, I think there was a big activist push to get both the private sector and the sort of global public sector involved in dealing with the epidemic. That led to things like the creation of the Global Fund, with I think it was about $10 to $12 billion that was put into dealing with HIV, TB, And now they deal with malaria as well and a bunch of other things. But there was a big push to get a whole bunch of different stakeholders, both locally and internationally, involved in dealing with the epidemic. And I think now, 10 years later, we're seeing the results of some of that. You know, again, there's a lot of work to be done. But that activist push and that effort initially put in by a lot of really vocal people has made a difference.
Well, in this country, safe sex was emphasized, and it seemed to have a real impact. And now we're hearing about people who are ignoring that, I guess because the feeling is that AIDS isn't as big a danger today as it was seen 10 or 15 years ago. Are we seeing something similar in Nigeria, or has there been a bit of a time lag?
No, I don't think we're seeing something similar. I mean, I think here the concept and the idea of AIDS fatigue is a really interesting one. In some senses, it suggests that people have done very, very well in communicating how that you can live with the epidemic. On the flip side, I think what's not necessarily communicated is that your life expectancy, if you do have HIV, is still decreased. And then at the same time, you taking the medications is not necessarily a pleasant experience all around. There are a lot of side effects, and they're getting better in terms of the side effect profile, but it's still not great. In Nigeria, I don't think we've reached that point. I think we're still looking to educate as many people as possible as to, look, this virus is there. And while there is a lot of awareness, now the next step is, what do you do? How do you live with the virus if you have it, and how does the society itself live with this epidemic?
Now, we have talked in the past about your novel about child soldiers in an unnamed West African country. Now we're talking about people living with AIDS in Nigeria. You are still pretty much an American. Are you going to write anything about the United States, or do you think Africa is going to be your subject for the rest of your life?
I
don't mean this in any... I'm always curious about how people right. choose what their topics are going to be.
No, I think the idea of my own identity factors into what I decide to write about. I mean, my next project that I've been working away on is a novel set in Washington, D.C., which is where I grew up. And I'm incredibly fascinated, especially at this point in time in our countries, and I say our country meaning the United States, sort of political evolution, what Washington, D.C. means both to the nation in general, and also to the people who are from that city and the surrounding area. So I think there's having a foot in both worlds, the United States and also Nigeria, and then being able to travel. You know, I've had a very privileged existence and ability to look at many different themes.
Well, there's obviously ambivalence about the United States throughout Africa. On the one hand, as we see, American culture, pop music, especially jazz, has had an incredible impact. Movies. On the other hand, a lot of resentment, a lot of anger, the possibility that America created AIDS.
I think in general, I think what there is some frustration about is the fact that it seems that the United States and other countries in what we call the West seem not to want to think of a different kind of Nigeria or a different kind of Africa or any other kind of country.
Uzodinma Iweala will be reading tonight at 6:30 at the New York Public Library's Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. That's at 515 Malcolm X Boulevard. And he will be reading with Teju Cole tomorrow night at 7:30 at Greenlight Bookstore at 686 Fulton Street in Brooklyn. Thank you so much.
Thank you.